you're just not good enough.
Everybody, James Irsay here. This is your invitation to join me Friday mornings from 10 a.m. to noon for Morning Irsay. We listen to great historical performances of mainly, but not exclusively, classical music with an emphasis on early scratchy piano recordings. And we also talk about them a lot. No need to dress up or even wash your face. Just sit around your home or office and enjoy 2 hours of diverting distraction as we broadcast great, hardly ever or even never heard performances of Golden Age musicians. Morning Irsay, Fridays 10 to noon on 99.5 WBAI and WBAI.org.
Thursday, October 2nd, is the first meeting of the New York City Safe Energy Coalition. We have a three-pronged approach to safe energy. Close the Indian Point nuclear plant, grow the renewable energy industry, and make our buildings more energy efficient. That's Thursday, October 2nd, at the New York Environmental and Justice Law Project. Join us at 6:30, 11 Park Place, Suite 701. That's near Broadway and near City Hall. Meeting starts at 7 p.m.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program devoted to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Once again this morning, we have scheduled Veronica Sheamus. Once again, Veronica is not A little dead air never hurt anybody. That's what I was just saying. Good morning again. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I got here on time, which is to say a little bit late, because there's all this stuff that I have to do in order to get the show rolling, including normally playing our movie review of the day, which I have right here in my keychain. And as long as you can hear, that means it's not ready for broadcast. And at the same time, I'm trying to get the bleeping computer here going. Well, I'm talking off mic. Let's see. What announcements do I have to make? None. Oh, yes, yes, yes. The next New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. The last one with Walter Mosley and Paul DiFilippo went very well. Our first foray ever into Brooklyn at 388 Atlantic Avenue on the ground floor of the Commons, where the third floor of the Commons is known as the offices of WBAI as opposed to the studios. It went well, but we will be back at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art at 138 Sullivan Street the first Tuesday in October, which I think is like the 6th. It's something like that. Look at a calendar, you know, find out. The 7th?
Maybe the
7th. It might be the 7th. I think you're right. But the readers will be Paul Park and James Morrow, two wonderfully cool, very strange when it comes to issues of religious thought. And we have an invitation out to somebody who, even more than Jim Morrow, will curdle the we'll just curdle people who are ultra-religious people. They will not like it whatsoever. It's Tuesday the 7th. Thank you, Dan. Whether or not the person who can not be named, David Silverman, will make it, he has to find out. He has to find out. He has a conflict, but he is so into trying to make this happen, as is his wife, who happens to be the editor of Space and Time magazine, which is a really nice semi-prozine. Science fiction, of course. We shall see. We shall see. But one way or the other, Jim Morrow and Paul Park are enough reasons for you to come Tuesday, October 7th, 138 Sullivan Street. I won't tell you. For more information, go to Facebook, because, frankly, I haven't had time. I have been so bleeping busy. I haven't had time to do the publicity yet. You're hearing it right now. You know, and there may or may not be somebody tuned in at the moment. So, in the meantime, oh yes, I actually did put my keys into the computer. Once I do that, that means that I can play a movie review.
Yay!
Which would be convenient, because that's why we are here. Now I actually brought a second. We're going to revisit later, a little later, not far later, Dan's review of The Congress, in which I have, since he did the review, seen.
And I'm so glad you did, because I've been dying to talk to somebody about this film.
Yeah, it's really worth discussing, and it brings up a whole range of discussion. And you are watching this film, and boy, do you want to root for it. It's Stanislav Lem. It's the guy who made Waltzing with Bashir.
Yeah.
Which, while I didn't necessarily appreciate all the politics of it, I appreciated the movie-making and the animation of it.
Yeah. It's Stanislaw Lem. Not only that, but it is a consortia of animators putting their hearts and souls into something very ambitious.
And very well.
Yeah. And
not quite as good as what Richard Linklater did with Waking Life and Scanner Darkly.
Right.
But in that neighborhood.
Yeah, we've got to talk about it because it's very ambitious and yet it fails.
We'll hear your review.
Yeah, you'll give the review.
My partner and I both sat there saying, right after the movie was over, boy, am I glad I saw that film.
Exactly.
But that was as much praise.
Yeah.
So do I recommend this film? Yes. Is it a good film? It fails.
Well, yes, exactly. It's one of these
curious things.
Yes, that's the thing.
It's really worth seeing for intelligent, ambitious science fiction, good movie making. It does do that.
Very good acting.
Excellent acting. Robin Wright, who plays a failed actress, which is funny, in the same year that she's gotten an Emmy nomination for
House of Cards.
Right. American version of
House of Cards.
With Kevin Spacey, American who lives in England. It gets confusing. Anyway, because I've seen the entire British trilogy.
Yeah, I've got that up on my Netflix queue. Haven't gotten to.
Oh, it's fun. Yeah. It's evil. It's even more evil than the American version.
Even better.
Yes.
Even better.
Well, not better. More evil.
Yes.
Anyway. Let us listen to a review of a movie that previously to today, I've never heard of.
Not many people have.
Okay, so...
opening in New York. It is playing in New York.
Okay. And, we'll talk about it shortly after we hear the review. Here it is.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. The weird thing about Space Station 76 is that it shouldn't be weird at all. It's a satire set on a commercial space station and presented as if it was seen through the lens of the 70s. So far, no big surprise. Poking fun at the me decade is by now a comedy staple. There was even a TV series devoted to it. So there shouldn't be any shock to being tossed into an environment whose pristine white corridors quote everything from 2001 to Space 1999, where the robots look like they were built by Tomy, because that's what the prop fabricators for this film actually used, where Todd Rundgren runs on continuous loop on the sound system, and where martinis, cigarettes, and mood suppressants flow like manna from heaven. But it's in what director Jack Plotnick and his team of four co-writers adapting their own stage play do in understanding the underlying emotional desperation of that decade and bringing it forward into, as one character puts it, the dreams of a future that never happened, that the film rises above its easy targets. Things aren't particularly copacetic on the Omega 76 space station. Closeted Captain Glenn Terry, played by Patrick Wilson, having driven away his lover, who was also his assistant captain, is wallowing in a despair that alternates between bitter sarcasm and a series of suicide attempts that are regularly thwarted by the station's always attentive computer system. Housewife Misty, played by Marissa Coughlin, spends her days ignoring her young daughter, unburdening herself to her robotic shrink, rejecting the advances of her husband Ted, played by Matt Bomer, and swallowing handfuls of Valium. Another housewife, Donna, played by co-writer Kali Rocha, is so obsessed with her husband Steve's rise up the corporate ladder that she doesn't notice that Steve, who's played by Jerry O'Connell, has been sleeping around with Misty. Into this hothouse environment comes a new assistant captain, Jessica Marlowe, played by Liv Tyler, whose very presence, not to mention her radical preference for career over family, threatens to throw this space-bound cul-de-sac into complete turmoil. And yeah, this is complete suburban melodrama, and meant to be, and very funny for how all the traditional backbiting, interpersonal politics, and family dysfunction translate into the science fiction trappings. Yet for all that, director Plotnick and team do not deny the pain that was coursing through the self-absorption and denial of the 70s. Space Station 76 is another beneficiary of the ongoing maturation of comedy, the kind of stuff championed by Judd Apatow and Dan Harmon, where the players can be caricatures and yet have a paradoxical amount of depth. This is a hard thing to pull off, and the film's cast overall handles it wonderfully. One of the best moments comes when Captain Terry, while unburdening himself to the robot psychiatrist, discovers the underlying simplicity of the machine's program. What starts out as comedy turns heartbreaking as the captain greets this revelation and the realization of his own isolation with both smug satisfaction and bitter resignation. For all the fun Space Station 76 has in deflating its soap opera cliches, that it doesn't begrudge its characters' genuine feelings and that we actually care about their fates makes it more than just a sexed-up Jetsons. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at MightyMoviePodcast.com. And if you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, be sure to check out CineFantastique Online at cfqonline.com.
Just imagine in your head that, that was a tight cycle.
I take for granted that you're always
Tunes. Hello, it's me, your Tunes listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio in New York City. WBAI at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org. And that is very possibly, in all the years that I've been doing radio at WBAI as an engineer or as a host of a program, possibly the first time I've knowingly played Todd Rundgren.
It's always your first time. You'll never forget your first time, mister.
Yeah, well, yeah, but you see, the thing is I was saying off the air, it seems like I like Rundgren, mm-hmm. but I never paid enough attention to know that that was him.
Well, yeah, here's the weird thing. And, well, first off, Rundgren is all over this film, Space Station 76. They use him a lot in it, and it was a
great... Now, where did this film come from, really?
You know what? It got its birth from, at least what I can glom from the credits, it got its birth as a stage play. Jack Plotnick is actually an actor. I think he's making his directorial
debut. That's right. You had mentioned that in the review. Yeah.
He's making his directorial debut. A lot of the people here are involved, I believe, with, like, improvisational comedy, UCB... Uh-huh. That sort of stuff. And so, and here again, the
UCB
credit...
UCB is United Citizens Brigade
United
for...
Citizens, yeah, Upright Citizens Brigade.
Upright Citizens Brigade. For those who are listening on the internet and not in the United States, may not know.
Yeah, that's true. It's Upright Citizens Brigade.
I didn't know. I said United.
The script is being credited to these five people.
X-Men Upright, that's the next.
It's being credited to these five people, so it's a collaborational thing, and I'm sort of suspecting that it was probably something that was born out of some sort of improvisational.
Yes, it sounds like something Firesign Theater might have come up
with. Yeah,
and they did. They did the Martian Space Party and a couple, and some really, sorry guys, I love the Firesign Theater, I worship you, but Zachariah...
That I don't know about.
Oh, yeah. Let's put it this way. I saw Zachariah more than once, this movie by the Farsign Theater, in their era. Actually, had a star in it. I don't remember who. And I saw it at the Elgin Cinema. That helps
date it. Back before it was the Joyce.
And
back before they got the marijuana fumes out of the theater.
No, they still haven't.
Oh, really? I haven't been to the Joyce in a while.
They really still haven't. And the young lady that sold the num-nums there, they didn't sell popcorn. They sold raisins and nut mix.
Yeah, yeah.
Is still a friend of mine.
Oh, really?
As a former WBAI on the air personality. Yeah. And we're Facebook friends and talk occasionally. At any rate, all that aside, Zachariah was a really, really great film after about the fifth toke.
The Elgin tended to run films like that.
Well, and on that basis, it was worth seeing.
Yeah. But you know, and speaking of that, I mean, the Elgin for me was the period of the 70s anyway. I was a student at NYU at that point. And what was interesting about hearing Rundgren, and the film opens, the opening credits roll over Rundgren's Utopia theme. And that sort of like put a shock into me right at the start. And I think it's very fitting back when I was a student at NYU back in the 70s, I had a roommate who really seriously thought that the future of music was Todd Rundgren. And at that point, it wasn't that hard an argument to make. He was actually a very adventurous musician and composer, the Utopia theme is part of an entire longer work, and he tended to do works that would push the limits of vinyl recording at that point. There was one piece that he did that I think ran something like 35 minutes on one side of an album, which was absolutely impossible to do at that point, except that he did it. The album actually came with a warning written on the album saying, you may have some trouble playing this particular side of the album. But the fact that here again, one of the characters talks about the memories of a future that never was. Rundgren was essentially, in some ways, part of that. He was the promise of a future that actually never came to
so
be.
So he is an alternate history.
Yes.
But ironically, he's still around.
I hope so. I was wondering about that.
Oh, no, he is. He is. You can see current performances on YouTube. And, you know, he's not young, but he's not pretending. He's not an a-hole. Like, who's the guy, the gun nut?
Ted Nugent.
Ted Nugent.
Oh, well, Ted Nugent, I mean, geez.
I mean, yeah. Talk about, yeah. 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 By the way, let me wish Ted Nugent and all of you a Lashana Tova. I rehearsed it at home, but I had to remember how to say it.
I'm sure Ted Nugent appreciates it.
Yeah, you know, and David, well, actually, David Silverman would.
Yeah, well,
and he doesn't describe himself totally as an atheist, because after all, he is a Jew.
Hmm.
Now, whether he believes in the Bible is a separate question.
That's the weird thing, and you know, I discovered this a few years ago. My nephew was having his bar mitzvah, and my wife was invited. Well, actually, we were both invited up to read from the Torah, you know, a passage from the Torah.
Mm.
And I said to my sister-in-law, you know, I hope you don't mind. I'm not going to read anything because I'm an atheist, and I just feel, you know, it wouldn't be right. It's not that I object personally or, you know, I would refuse to. I just felt it just wasn't, you know,
appropriate.
And she said, no, that's absolutely fine. You just come up with your wife and, you know, you stand by her and that'll be fine. And she said, but, you know, you're still a Jew. And I said, I realized, yeah. Holy bleep, she's right.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, if I wasn't a Jew, I'd have relatives, but they were all killed in Germany.
Yeah.
So, so it doesn't matter what they believed in. That's it.
And it's unusual because is there another religion that can say, if you're a Catholic and you become an atheist, do they...
Lapsed Catholics tend to call themselves that.
Yeah.
Yes. They tend to not so much, this is my observation, mm-hmm. One of two things happen. Number one, they still believe in what they believe, mm-hmm. but they have great anger at the church itself.
Yeah.
They don't like the structure of the church, and they may welcome another schism that would allow them
But you see, you're talking about here people of faith as opposed... People who still have the faith.
People who do not have the faith. Rick Bose, who was here a couple of weeks ago, would be the person to ask this question.
Yeah.
But generally, they say, I was raised this.
Yeah.
But they don't call themselves that actively.
Yeah.
But being Catholic is not a race. It's purely a religious thing.
Mm-hmm.
Being a Jew is a racial statement.
It's true. Yeah.
Yeah, and
that's correct.
And that's it. Is that you cannot tell if a person is Catholic from their DNA, but you know if they're Jewish from their DNA.
Yeah,
and that's it.
Yeah.
But the other thing I notice about a lot of people who hate Catholicism is they become Satanists, not witches.
Hmm.
Although there were some witches in Margot Adler's coven who were simply expressing their disenfranchisement with the church. But Satanism is the inverse of Catholicism. Yeah. You don't get Protestants who become Satanists. Mm-hmm. And at least we're talking about the Anton LaVey. Well, anyway. Yeah. But there was a time, by the way, when this was one of the main topics of Hour of the Wolf. Because when Hour of the Wolf is on 5 days a week, 5 to 7 a.m., Monday through Friday, with Margot Adler as the creator mm-hmm. and host of the show, and I was her co-host Thursdays and Fridays. Thursdays and Fridays were science fiction. Mm. And even then, we might be discussing paganism. Mm. But Margot Adler, it can be argued, brought paganism, neo-paganism, Wiccan thinking on a popular basis to North America. Mm. Without her book, Drawing Down the Moon, it's very unlikely that the Wiccan movement would be what it is. People wouldn't have written Joss Whedon and saying, no, no, you can't do Willow that way. She's got to be like this. And Margot's book was cited. Mm. And that's it. Drawing Down the Moon, since Margot published it in 1977, has never been out of print. Mm. And we had not one but two pagan shows, two neo-pagan shows on WBAI. Marion Weinstein, or Weinstein, not Weinstein, did Marion's Cauldron. Hello, hello. She really had that voice. And Adler would basically, you know, she would talk about her paganism and all that, which she did not do when she was a journalist on National Public Radio because she was afraid that that the fact that she was a witch mm-hmm. would be used against her by the wrong people as a left-leaning journalist. Mm-hmm. I mean, here on BAI, we're not left-leaning. We're
we
pushed that wall over a long time ago.
You flung yourself all the way over to
yeah. We're not
leaning here. No tentativeness in this arena.
Yeah, exactly. But yes, Hour of the Wolf was very often, and our scheduled guest tonight, Veronica Shaness. She's the only person who ever I started to explain what Hour of the Wolf was. And she explained it to me far better than I knew it. And not because she had... Now, you probably know why the title.
No. No. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Go, 1967. Go. Movie.
1967.
You have the title. It's called Hour of the Wolf. The director.
Ingmar Bergman.
You
yes,
got it.
Okay, okay. Starring right, yeah. Okay, sorry
Starring
about that.
Starring Liv Ullmann yeah. and Max von Sydow. Yeah. I've got the trailer right here. Should I play it? No, I won't play it.
No.
I won't play it.
They did a very funny satire of it on SCTV.
Yes. Yes, they did. And an appropriate one, too.
Yeah.
Although it's sort of like, it's not one of Bergman's best mm-hmm. films, but I think that Bergman's bad films are better than most
people's. Here's the thing. He's one of those directors that's like pizza. Even when it's bad, he's pretty darn good. Yeah.
Yeah. And Hour of the Wolf is a fascinating film. It's on Netflix.
Yeah.
I recommend it.
But another thing to put on my queue.
Yeah. Yeah. But Bergman didn't invent Hour of the Wolf. It is a concept from Scandinavia, from, mm-hmm. you know, the Sweden. The idea of the, I have to do it. Hold on. Because it is actually relatively easy to find on this horrible computer here. HODW Music. And here we are.
The Hour of the Wolf is the hour between night and dawn. It is the hour when most people die, when sleep is deepest, when nightmares are most real.
It's the trailer from the film.
Yeah.
I don't know the voices.
No, I'm asking the description.
When ghosts and demons are most powerful.
Whether it was...
The Hour of the Wolf is also the hour when most children are born.
Oh, Bergman made this.
Oh, did he?
Oh, this is Ingmar Bergman.
Oh, yes. Bergman.
Oh, yeah. But this is the concept, as Veronica Shaness would explain it. And an important thing to understand, it's the time between night and dawn. It is the morning twilight.
Hour of the wolf. The hour in which reality becomes a mockery of madness and masks hide behind faces.
You just know that's 1967, yes. Right? It just reeks.
It's a sham of a mockery.
It's the same atmosphere as in The Elgin, which is, I think, where I first saw this movie. It was either the... Anyway, it's a long trailer.
Yeah.
But at any rate, so Veronica just says, oh, well, Hour of the Wolf is, you know, the time between night and dawn and all that. And it's like, well, yeah, but night and dawn, how long is that? 2 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, in Sweden?
Yes, exactly. Okay.
The right time of year...
It could go on a while.
There's a Stephen Sondheim song from A Little Night Music, which is, of course, based on...
Smiles of a Summer Night.
By Bergman.
Yes.
And Act Two begins with a song, 8 o'clock, twilight, 9 o'clock, twilight, 10 o'clock, twilight, 11 o'clock. It's getting dark. Mm-hmm. And... So, and in the morning twilight, Hour of the Wolf can be 3 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the deal. That's the deal with Hour of the Wolf. That's where the title of this radio show comes from. Now, mentioning the Farsight Theater, there's, of course, the Hour of the Wolf news on Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers.
Is that real?
Absolutely. And they refer to the Hour of the Wolf movie with George Tirebiter.
Okay.
Then... A former Pacifica person who was involved at KPFA, we had a guy, BAI, who occasionally did this show with Margot Adler on Mondays, named Mike Hodel. He was a news person. He moved to L.A. to become news director, and there he started a radio show called Hour 25.
Mm.
Hodel died young. Horribly. Yeah. I mean, you know, he wasn't 50. Yeah. Brain hemorrhage. Same kind of thing as Terry Carr. And one of his pals, buds, there, a guy by the name of Harlan something. Ellison?
Never heard of him.
That was one. And when he lived in New York, he often dropped in on Hour of the Wolf. And when he was in L.A., he often dropped in on Hour 25.
Hmm.
And he would bring with him this guy who had an idea for television named Mike Straczynski, J. Michael Straczynski.
Never heard of him.
Now, so Straczynski does an episode. The first episode of the fourth season of Babylon 5 is called...
Hour of the Wolf.
And in there, he has... You're doing the Mad Libs great here. He also makes a reference.
It's not that hard.
And they're counting down all the time it has to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then at Hour 25, one of them says, this is Hour of the Wolf. And the Claudia Christian character gives... absolutely the wrong effing definition of what Hour of the Wolf is supposed to be.